Welcome. I want to thank you all for being here today to the first in a series of talks on stress management for care providers. This program is funded by the Fund for Greatest Need from UWMC Hospital, and I think it's a win-win situation for all of us, because if we can manage our stress better, I think we're going to be happier. And by managing our stress and being a little less reactive, we are going to make those around us probably happier as well. The subtitle here is Self-Care for Those Who Care. And again, I want to stress that this is self-care, and that's going a little against the grain for many of us, where we've been taught to put patients and work and family certainly before ourselves. And one of the themes of this is that by taking care of ourselves, we're going to take care of others better, because we're just better able to do that. What I think a lot of our experience reflects is that arriving in the hospital can be like jumping in a lake full of alligators. What we do is difficult. Our work is hard. We're exposed to many things that the usual or the average man on the street is never exposed to, in terms of human suffering, in terms of death, in terms of scrutiny of ourselves, and of our institution. So I think first thing is just to admit that what we do is very hard, and can sort of be like being up to your ass in alligators and forgetting that you come to drain the swamp. So how does this affect healthcare providers? Well, physician mortality is about the same as that of other professionals, except for a few factors, and those factors I think can be very telling. Healthcare providers and physicians in particular have higher suicide rates than the general population. And in fact, in men, this is probably double the suicide rate, and women, it may be up to maybe four, even five times the rate in the general population. I think this is extremely telling. This is certainly just the tip of the iceberg as far as the results of the mental pressures that we're put under. We also have an increased number of accidents. I know that when I was a resident that I had several minor fender benders, which were just due to inattention, to my thinking about what had gone on in the hospital, to pressures that were on me, to thinking about what I was going to do next instead of what I was doing at the moment. We also have an increased number of drug-related problems, higher addiction rates, and higher accidents from drug-related problems. African-American providers have an increased incidence of ischemic heart disease over their counterparts. This graph just reflects what I just said, basically. We do pretty well in terms of some infectious disease, HIV, liver disease, hepatitis, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We don't smoke. And we don't get as much pneumonia, influenza, probably because we get vaccinated. So on the other hand, we do take care of ourselves in some ways. Unfortunately, we have increased rates of burnout, and I want to talk quite a bit about burnout in a little bit. Related to that, we have increased rates of depression and anxiety, and in fact, this seems to be about twice that in the general population. It seems to be highest in academics, which certainly concerns us, women, and younger faculty, which are under some pressures in academia, I think, which don't, at least aren't as prominent in private practice. We have slightly higher rates of divorce. Interestingly, most of us do not have a private physician taking care of us. In fact, only about 40% do. We do a lot of self-care. But on the other hand, we have poor self-care habits. We don't take care of ourselves as well as other professionals. One thing that's shown up in the past years is that also we have a decreasing career satisfaction. So we spend a great deal of time in careers that we're becoming less satisfied with. I think one of the most telling things is that only 50% of physicians now would recommend that their children go into medicine, and it used to be much higher. This can be also reflected in an earlier retirement age, which is lead to increased manpower problems and problems in healthcare in our society. In one study, in a survey of 114 graduates of the University of Wisconsin Surgical Training Program, 50% of the surgeons were in poor health by the age of 49. Many rarely exercised, and 20% retired early. In this study, they found the length of a career in medicine was determined by post-residency factors, not their training, including major health issues, preventative health patterns, exercise, alcohol use and dependency, troubles with family life, and practice satisfaction. So the stress that we undergo and our response to it affects ourselves, our practice of medicine, and is interrelated with our family life. So let's talk a little bit about burnout. Burnout is a syndrome present in many individuals under constant pressure or stress over a long time. And burnout is a little like battle fatigue in the military, and I think there's a number of similarities between the military and medicine. I think basically, if you want a definition of burnout, it's getting to the point where you just don't care anymore. This has been subcategorized into three different categories: emotional and physical exhaustion, depersonalization, and a decreased sense of personal accomplishment. All these, I think, again, related to not caring anymore. Unfortunately, as Dr. Peabody says in this quote, the secret to caring for the patient is to care for the patient. So our mental state, our emotional state, our rested state reflects on how we care for our patients. And I think if you look at most of the studies, The satisfaction of patients relates to really how present the doctor was, how they related to you during that visit. Unfortunately, the American College of Surgeons in 2008 did a survey and found that 40% of responding surgeons met the criteria for burnout by standardized tests. 32% were emotionally exhausted. 30% screened positive for depression. Again, I said this as before, this is probably twice as high as in the general population. 26% demonstrated high depersonalization. They didn't really relate anymore to people as people. And interestingly, 13% had a low sense of personal accomplishment. In one trial of giving this same evaluation form, the mileage burnout inventory, to a department here at the University of Washington, 50% of people had a low sense of self, of personal accomplishment, which is pretty amazing consider how objectively accomplished our faculty is. How does this all happen? Well, I think it happens over time, and it happens slowly. It's the theory of the frog in the boiling water. If you put a frog in a glass of boiling water, it'll jump out. It'll realize the change that happens and try to keep itself healthy. If, however, you put a frog in a glass of water and then heat it up, it may just boil to death because it doesn't quite realize what's happening and becomes accustomed to the rise in temperature. We have both a lot of external stress, but we also have a lot of internal stress. And certainly we have very high perfection, high expectations of ourselves, and a high degree of perfectionism. Now, some of this is necessary, but when we're entirely judging ourselves all the time, this can create an amount of stress that is actually detrimental to our functioning. We often also deny our human limitations and needs, both mental and physical. We don't eat that well, we don't exercise, and we don't pay attention and keep ourselves as mentally fit as possible. We're very task-oriented and spend a lot of time worrying about the future as opposed to actually enjoying what we do now. When we do take care of ourselves, there's oftentimes a high degree of guilt if we're not taking care of our If we're taking care of ourselves, we're not taking care of our patients. So we lack a certain amount of self-compassion. And studies have now shown that self-compassion is one of the major determinants of how happy we are, if we think we deserve our own compassion. And realistically, we're under an increasing workload and external demands, more documentation, more scrutiny of what we do, and we're certainly encouraged to do higher volume. We don't know how to say no, and we've had a lot of training in that. I know during my residency, I to say no to a request or a need of a attending physician was just unheard of. I did learn how to say no to my wife and my son. And what we practice is what we get good at. And when we get out of our residencies, I think we still don't know how to say no at the hospital, but we've usually become well practiced in saying no to maybe the most significant people in our life. We pick physicians very carefully. And we try to pick the people that we think are going to make the best doctors. And before medical training, we try to pick people that are empathetic, compassionate, curious, have multiple interests, good health habits, are able to support multiple roles, have a positive mood, or thoughtful, altruistic, and humanitarian. After our medical training, I think it changes us. Our empathy turns to a depersonalization, as the stress test and burnout tests show. We become less compassionate and turn more to a survival mode. Our natural curiosity turns into a task-oriented, list-doing process. Our multiple interests change to, we become more single-minded in terms of medical practice. Our health habits deteriorate, and we become more identified with the physician role and less identified perhaps with the role of friend, athlete, family person, father, and mother. Our positive mood turns to one of more skepticism. We become more reactive. We're not as thoughtful. Maybe we don't have as time. We've been trained not to take so much time to make decisions, and we become more reactive. We also become more self-protective, and I think that many of us think we're just a little more than human, and we can take more without doing the things that make us resilient human beings. Being burnout and allowing ourselves to become burnout also has consequences for our patients and our professional judgment. It's been shown that physicians and providers who are burnout show poorer judgment in patient care. They have more difficulty in decision-making and actually exhibit more hostility towards their patients. They're not having a good time, so they have less patience. There are more medical errors made by burnout providers, more adverse patient events, and perhaps a more diminished commitment and dedication to optimal patient care. Because people just, they're burnt out. They don't care as much as they did anymore. And this can also lead to a diminished relation with colleagues. The burnout becomes most significant in about 15% of all physicians who are declared actually impaired sometime during their career. The hospital and the university has spent a lot of time trying to correct system problems and problems that occur because of outside events. And we tried to decrease the number of irritating or dangerous events that occur in the hospital. But our experience is a sum total of what happens with these outside events and how we internally process these. And we have not spent, in my opinion, enough time on giving people the tools to better internally process the stressful environment in which we have voluntarily put ourselves. And that is really the intent of this new stress management program. Medicine will always be stressful, and we can't expect ourselves to be perfectly happy by only changing outside events. The program we've instituted basically has multiple arms, which should serve hopefully the best the interests of a diverse amount of care providers. There are certainly care providers which are doing very well and thriving. There are also people who are severely burnt out from their as a result of the way they interact with the stressful environment, and it's a significant minority of people. So we want to serve people who are maybe need a little help, as well as people who may need a lot of help. We have a website, which is listed on this slide and is in the brochures, and provides many links to many resources that are already out there for healthcare providers, and links to videos, mindfulness practices, books, journal articles, scientific articles, etc. We're also providing these lectures, and thank you for coming. And on Monday noons, we're providing a mindfulness practice introductions. And I would hope this to be a introduction to meditation, as well as more informal practices, which you can do during the day, which don't take any time at all out of your day, but could produce significant benefits. The biggest part of the program is probably the mindfulness-based stress reduction courses, which last once a week for 8 weeks, 2 to 3 hours, plus some homework. So it is a commitment in which we teach you to quiet your mind, become aware of your habits, both good and bad, examine your values, how you can change your life to make it a little more fair to yourself and as well as others, and to promote self-compassion. And the reason we give this course is it's really one of the only things that has proven in healthcare providers to be an antidote to burnout. So this is, we think this is really an important part of the project. We encourage you to participate in one study. Follow-up of people that took these MBSR courses 4 years after they took the course, they were 80% were still practicing something in the course. And to me, that's pretty amazing. They did find value in what they were taught. We make a number of assumptions in our stress management course, and first is, as I've stated, that practicing medicine and surgery can be bad for your health. It is important for providers to be physical and mentally healthy as possible. You are the, quote, tool, unquote, of medicine, and you have to take care of your tools. In order to be healthy, it is important to take control. And we can control our brains and behavior by what we practice, which is our habits. Our brains actually grow when we practice certain things, and both our mental and habits are hard to break. I'm not saying this is easy, and new habits are hard to make. But this is really what we have to do because I think studies have shown and that it is important for us to be aware of and prevent and treat the problem of burnout and poor provider health. Improving our health is good for ourselves, our patients, and our loved ones. Very important. And I think institutional support systems such as this program can improve health and facilitate the culture change we need to improve both ours, health, and the care of our patients. So we need to recognize and accept the problem, form an intent to address the problem, not only for yourself, but for your loved ones and patients, make a plan for change, and then I think which is the hardest thing is make room in your life for the plan. Now, it doesn't have to be a lot of room, but you may have to stop doing something or decrease the amount of something you're doing in order to really make this a priority. I'll later try to give you some tools that can show you how you can actually minimize the amount of time this may take. We need to institute the plan, expand if necessary, revise as needed, but practice, practice, practice. We only change by what we practice. We become much of what we do, and then repeat. This is a lifelong process. The stress will not stop, and the stress is part of our job. The worst thing I think we can do is to resign ourselves that this is just the way it is and that nothing can be done about it. Something can be done about it. This is a couple quotes from some very famous physicians on retirement, which most of us are heading for. Dr. Mayo from Mayo Clinic, "We take life so seriously that there is nothing to fill our leisure hours during our waking years, and when retirement comes, we have nothing to enjoy. We neglect, often at least, the non-medical parts of our life." And Sir William Osler, probably the most famous physician, "Engrossed late and soon in professional cares, you may so lay waste your powers that you may find too late, with hearts given away, that there is no place in your habit-stricken souls, for those greater influences which make your life worth living." Our training is all about developing good habits for the care of our patients. We need to include ourselves in that circle of compassion and care for ourselves as well, both for its own sake and so that we can care for our patients. This is a mindfulness-based program, and as I said, the mindfulness-based programs have been shown to be effective, and that's one reason we're using this type of program. And I want you to just, for a minute, examine the differences between experience and thoughts. And in this program, and in MBSR, there's a great deal of emphasis on experiencing the present. In the patient's room, this translates into really being present for the patient and learning how to listen, and somewhat separating this from your thoughts, which are always about past and present. The average physician interrupts a patient after 17 seconds of talking by the patient, And we need to learn to be better listeners and not just listen to our own thoughts and lens. Our patients will be happier. And it's also been shown that people that are paying attention to what is they are doing right at the present time to their experience, tend to be considerably happier than people who spend more time daydreaming or paying attention to their own thoughts. So what is mindfulness? I think a good definition is mindfulness is paying attention to the present moment on purpose. Part of this program is meditation, and I have actually never seen a definition of mindfulness that includes the word meditation. But meditation is the formal practice of mindfulness. It's taking some time out to practice awareness and paying attention. And it can be very calming, and it can actually improve the paying attention and awareness functions, the executive functions in your brain. So we start to develop a different relationship with our thoughts. I saw a bumper sticker the other day. You don't need to believe everything you think. So it's creating a little space around our thoughts. It's what our mind does. Thoughts are extremely useful, but they totally define us. Another saying I've heard, and which I like, is that thoughts make a great servant, but a poor master. And in that sense, it's all about becoming a little less reactive and a little more responsive, having some thoughts, monitoring our feelings, and sort of getting a better handle on things before we act. So how does mindfulness work? If you start out with someone who's, say, very self-concerned, getting more isolated, ruminating about either problems in the future or what they've done in the past, and becoming more burned out, and all of these things go together. If you teach this person how to quiet their mind, pay attention on purpose, and increase their concentration, they start to create some space around their thoughts. Their thoughts are not so much all consuming, and you can actually start to disidentify somewhat with thoughts and emotions. You can watch them. And anything you can watch, you can start to control. So by watching something, you are not that object. By being able to do that, you sort of broaden your scope of attention. Thoughts, emotions are part of your attention. Sensations, experience also become part of your attention. And things that you may not notice become part of your attention. So your mind starts to expand, and you start to feel increased connections to others in the world, things in the world, and that these connections have been shown to be related to happiness, and it's a pretty consistent connection. This develops positive emotions, self-compassion, and an improved outlook. There are many things driving this equation, both from the improved outlook to the burnout and back and forth. And hopefully there are things in this program that decrease burnout and lead to an improved outlook. One such study, which has actually become quite famous by Krasner, he gave people an MBSR program, providers, 8 weeks, and at the end of 8 weeks, people were more mindful, less burnout in all the scales, increased empathetic, believed they were doing important work, and that they were doing it well. They were less depressed, less mood disturbance, and had more personality stability. So by objective measures, providers benefited personally from MBSR classes. In this study, a control group and a meditation group was given a mindfulness practice and measured their, and the measurement was made of their emotional state. After 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, their emotional state considerably improved over a non-intervention group. And interestingly, this intervention was simply wishing yourself and others well. Something which actually takes very little time, is pleasant in itself, and something that's going to be both part of our mindfulness training and the MBSR courses. I find this a very interesting study, stress and medical malpractice. It was performed by the insurance industry, and it was a survey and intervention study in 61 hospitals covering 12,000 individuals. And in this study, they measured job stress, job satisfaction, organizational stress, and personal stress. And they found that workplace stress correlated with the number of malpractice claims. The more stress, the more malpractice claims. They then took a subset of hospitals, which were matched by amount of stress, and in half of them started a stress management program, and the other half did not. At the end of 1 year, in the control hospitals, which had no stress management program, the number of malpractice claims was practically the same, 36 1 year and 35 the next. In the experimental group, the malpractice frequency decreased from 31 the first year to 9 in the second year. So it had approximately a two-thirds decrease in malpractice claims. They also looked at number of medication errors in these hospitals. And before intervention, it was about 10 medication errors per month, and this decreased to about 5 medication errors per month. So a stress management program actually decreased the number of malpractice suits and the number of medication errors. This intervention was good for the hospitals, the providers, and the patients. I bring this next slide up just to show again in a different way that MBSR training has an effect and measurable effects. And in 8 weeks, you can actually measure brain growth in certain areas. And these areas are largely concerned with the prefrontal cortex and executive function of the brain. Some other areas as well, but this was a controlled study by Sarah Lazar, just completed last year, and it's pretty incredible to me that in 8 weeks you can get actual brain growth. There's a new book out called The Brain That Changes Itself, and indeed you are capable of changing your own brain. So I think there's a basic assumption in medicine that people perform better and are happier when they are mentally and physically healthy. And the corollary to this that we have to remember is medical staff are people. So medical staff perform better and are happier when they are mentally and physically healthy. So I think we've had a number of priorities in our hospital, and these priorities are important. Certainly the first one is patient care. That's what we're here for. We have a certain financial responsibility to keep our institution in a sustainable mode. Because we're an academic hospital, we have research and education as priorities. But I think our fourth priority needs to be made provider wellness, and this needs to be physical and mental. And I think if we do this, we will have better patient care, pay more attention, and therefore have better financial responsibility and have more energy for both research and education. I really want to thank you all for coming today. I want to give you a little practice. I've said that mindfulness is paying attention to the present moment. And I think one of the first things that we need to do is sort of realize what that is. So I'm going to ask you to stand up and, okay, just stand up. Just assume erect posture and shift your attention from inside your heads, which, if you're like me, is where I live most of the time, down to your body, to the soles of your feet, and just feel the pressure there. Don't try to change anything. Just be aware of those sensations. If your mind should go back up in your head and you start thinking about it, just realize that and go back and shift your awareness into the soles of your feet. When you're comfortable with that, pick up one foot. Move your attention to the sole of the foot on the floor. Take a step. Shift your attention to the sole of the new foot on the floor. And repeat. Step. One moment. Let go of that moment. Step. Next moment, pay attention to the other foot. One foot, one moment, two foot, next moment. And repeat. I think for most of us, that's quite a different experience than our usual mindless walking. And it's just a practice. By paying attention to the moment, to a sensation, we're practicing paying attention. And the more we practice paying attention, the better attention we pay. We practice something just like a surgeon practices tying knots till it becomes automatic. We can practice paying attention to anything, really, and improve our ability for paying attention. There's a wonderful book by Jan Chosen Bays. It's called How to Train a Wild Elephant. And it's full of small practices like this, which take no time out of your day. There's 52 practices. Each practice is about 3 or 4 easy reading pages. And I want to offer this book to you. I want you to form an intent to read 3 or 4 pages a week. Practice the specific instructions given, which are very simple, during your day. And if possible, share this with someone else. Talk about it for 5 minutes once a week. If you can form an intent to do that, please have one of these books. And thank you again for coming. Try to fill out the forms for the evaluation forms. Any suggestions, certainly welcome. This is the first time we've given this program, and your feedback is extremely valuable. Thanks again, and have a good day, a good week, and a good career.